Good Tuesday, August 6th. I'm Phil Picardi. This is the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Today, the new Minneapolis police chief addresses racism in the department. State officials investigate a death in the sex offender program. What Target and other retailers are doing to assure better clothing industry working conditions and getting patients more involved with their health care. Minneapolis Police Chief Janae Harto says recent racially charged incidents involving off-duty officers have pushed the department to a, quote, turning point. In two separate incidents in Apple Valley and in Green Bay, Wisconsin, white Minneapolis police officers got in fights with black civilians. In the Green Bay incident, police reports say the officers used racial slurs. Chief Harto says the department will have to make changes as a result. She spoke to All Things Considered and Stephen John.
The incidents we've heard about most recently in Green Bay and Apple Valley happened when the officers involved were off duty and apparently having too much to drink. How much can your department control police officers' off-duty behavior?
Well, you know, we do have a code of conduct, whether you're on duty or off duty. We are currently reviewing the off-duty policy to see where we might make some changes. First and foremost, that people are personally accountable for their actions and how they conduct themselves both on duty and off duty. And we expect them to be held to a higher standard. And what I saw certainly in Green Bay did not meet those standards.
Now, is there a culture of racist attitudes in parts of the Minneapolis Police Department?
Well, I think that we certainly have a department filled with individuals, and individuals have their own thought processes. And so what I'm looking to do is to call out individuals when we see those things. I'm asking what I believe we have a silent majority in our police department, like others, where officers do great things every day. Great work, and they're very angry and they're very frustrated with what they saw on the video and audio in Green Bay. And I'm asking them to no longer be silent. I'm asking them to be holding each other accountable. To label the Minneapolis Police Department would be no different than labeling other people.
Now, aside from having individual cops kind of police themselves, how can you as police chief change police culture?
Well, it starts with hiring the right people. It starts in setting the tone with what I expect officers to be like and to act like. And I did that from day one when we met and we talked about how we operate under our core values of commitment, integrity, and transparency, honoring our code of ethics and the law enforcement code of ethics. And when people vary from that, depending on the degree, that I am swift with discipline. And that has to be supported by our union. And the other part is training. I don't believe, though, when you have individuals who are racist, training does not solve that. Training does not make racism go away. But we can improve our hiring practices, I believe. We can ensure that we're diversifying our department more than we have. It's a challenge to do, but it's something we need to look at doing.
You apologized for the officers in Green Bay using racist language and for the disrespect they seemed to show to fellow officers in Wisconsin. But one of them also allegedly showed disrespect to you personally with a derogatory comment about your sexual orientation and that you were looking to fire people for any reason. Isn't that kind of subordination enough reason to fire someone?
Well, you know, as a police chief or a boss, I think you have to take a certain amount of backlash. I don't like it, but it does come with the territory. When you start, however, speaking derogatory about sexual orientation, that impacts a whole other larger group. And that group was very offended. There are many people who are offended. And so that takes it to a whole new level. But for me personally, these are, you know, like I said, I don't like it, but it doesn't mean that I don't have to accept some of it. That's part of being a boss. I would challenge anybody to say, if you're a boss, that nobody's ever said anything disparagingly about you.
Police Chief Harto, who have you brought in from outside the department so far to discuss possible changes in police culture going forward?
Well, I have developed earlier in the year a Chief Citizens Advisory Council group. There's about 22 individuals that are from all different sectors of the community. And we began some of those conversations earlier in the year and how we would build public trust. They will be meeting with me on Wednesday as well at 3 o'clock, along with many others, the union, civil rights, some other faith-based leaders. I always feel that those closest to the issues probably have the solutions in mind. I could do diversity training tomorrow that would have little or no impact. I'm talking about real institutionalized change. And so what does that look like? I don't know exactly what it looks like. I have a couple of ideas, but I really want to hear from this group of people first.
What is it that you think some officers don't understand about the communities they serve, and especially communities of color?
You know, I call it this thing, you know, what do they see and think when they see me coming? So whether it be a police officer coming towards a citizen or a citizen towards a police officer, we all have our own thoughts on what it is we see coming. When officers make statements, and even though it's not you and it's two officers out of 850, it has an impact, and we need to acknowledge the impact that it has on people. And when situations like this come up, it stirs a history of bad feelings. The other thing is I don't just want to add the perspective of the community with the officers. I think it's important that the community understands the perspective of the officers and what they go through and see. You know, and officers have families, and their families are impacted. So this isn't just a one-side process. This is both sides. If we're going to make real change and real understanding and build real relationships, community needs to get to know officers, and officers need to know community members.
Are you optimistic there will be some real change regarding the way police see others within the Minneapolis Police Department?
I am. I think this is a turning point. I think that, unfortunately, we've had some real negative incidents, but I believe that this is a turning point because people are motivated when they get angry, when they're frustrated, when they say enough is enough. And whether it be internally in this department or externally in the community, people have had enough.
That's Minneapolis Police Chief Janae Harto with Stephen John on All Things Considered. The Minnesota Department of Human Services says a man committed to the Minnesota Sex Offender Program took his own life last weekend. Here's Rupa Shenoy with more.
DHS Deputy Commissioner Ann Barry says the 45-year-old man died Saturday after an apparent suicide attempt Friday.
We have natural deaths. We have people who have, you know, have died of cancers and other diseases, but this is the first, as far as we know, this is the only suicide in the history of the sex offender treatment program.
Several other offenders identify the man as Ray Messer. Messer was civilly committed to the state's treatment program after two criminal sexual conduct convictions. Barry says so far this year there have been six cases where patients' self-inflicted injuries required medical attention. The department says emergency room staff classified two as attempted suicides. Last year, nine men at the state's Moose Lake treatment facility attempted to harm themselves. One was deemed a suicide attempt. Barry says on average, there have been about 9 or 10 cases of self-inflicted injuries a year. Offenders held at Moose Lake say those numbers don't match their perceptions. They think suicide attempts are increasing. Wallace Bolio, an offender committed to the program in 2006 after convictions for kidnapping and criminal sexual conduct in the third degree, says the suicide attempts are brought on by stress and frustration. A lawsuit challenging Minnesota's sex offender program says it doesn't provide real treatment. Lawyers say the fact that only one person has been released is proof. Bolio says offenders are watching the work of a court-mandated task force closely. There was speculation last legislative session that if lawmakers didn't take action, a federal judge would force changes. The Department of Human Services is negotiating a settlement to the lawsuit. Bolio says every development causes an emotional wave through Moose Lake.
The last few months, everybody was hoping things were changing. The DHS was going back and forth with the attorneys about settling the case, and everybody thought, you know, that was going to be something that's going to be a big change, halfway houses and all this talk about, you know, lesser restrictives, and none of it happened. The legislature didn't do anything, so, you know, it was like went from a big high to a pretty fast low.
Bolio says he's tried to kill himself twice by cutting himself with the cheap razors for sale in the facility canteen. He says they're a common tool. Other patients say they've used drugs. 44-year-old Roger Gilbertson was convicted of multiple counts of criminal sexual conduct. He was civilly committed to the Moose Lake facility in 2007, and within a few years, Gilbertson says, he tried to kill himself.
And what I did is I saved up a whole bunch of amitriptyline, which is Elavil, and I overdosed on that. I was in the hospital for about 6 days, I think it was.
The Minnesota Sex Offender Program currently has 683 clients who each cost the state $326 a day. In 2011, the state's legislative auditor documented a chronic problem with clinical understaffing. Some offenders inside say they're trying to kill themselves because they don't get help. 57-year-old Ken Timms says he molested children in parks and fought to be committed to the sex offender program because he wanted treatment. He says 3 months ago, he slit his arm open with a razor blade out of frustration.
I would rather be dead than offend again. I think a lot of the guys here don't belong here, but they don't belong on the street right away either. I'm one of them. I don't need to be behind a fence. But I do need psychiatric help.
After questions from NPR, DHS Deputy Commissioner Barry says the program will investigate the availability of razors at the facility. She says the program's clinical staffing has improved dramatically since the auditor's report, and she says officials try hard to show offenders in the program they should have hope.
Although only one person has moved into the community to this point, there are a number of people who have moved to the higher phases of treatment and may soon be ready for community placement.
Barry says program offenders may have more reasons to hope they can move out of the secure facility soon once they complete required treatment.
Rupa Shenoy on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. People across the state are closing their streets to traffic tonight for National Night Out block parties. Matt Sepik reports.
More than 15,000 communities across the country and many in Minnesota are taking part in National Night Out. Two of the top participants last year were St. Paul and Minneapolis. Both cities won top honors from the National Association of Town Watch for their efforts in 2012. Karen Notch is a civilian crime prevention specialist with the Minneapolis Police Department. She says meeting your neighbors is the main purpose of National Night Out.
Minneapolis really takes it seriously. We really believe that National Night Out is an event what really focuses on crime prevention, encourages people to look out for their neighbors and get to know their neighbors.
Notch says more than 1,400 block parties are scheduled in Minneapolis. Around 300 are planned in St. Paul, and there will be about 50 tonight in Duluth. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Joining us now on the podcast is Michael Olson, the editor of Minnesota Today, and today's question at nprnews.org, and also the editor of the statewide blog. And what's that all about?
Yes, the statewide blog is a blog that we've had for a while, which initially started with our regional reporters from around the state, folks that are outside of the metro area. We created that as a space for them to file their stories, and we're broadening it out and letting more people contribute to it. So we're just following different trends and news and events from around the state there.
And right now on the statewide blog, you're looking at perhaps a locally made bicycle. I guess not perhaps. It's being done, right?
Yeah. This is to kick off a series that Molly Bloom and I started. It's called Minnesota Made. And so we asked people what they are into. And one thing that came back to us was people really love QBP. And this is Quality Bicycle Products. Mm-hmm. And they're not necessarily a household name. And I think they kind of like it that way in a sense, because they are they're a massive distributor of bicycle products. So they serve over 5,000 independent retailers. Mm. And it, you know, you wonder, okay, so how is this something that's a Minnesota made deal? Well, they're based in Bloomington. And they have a range of brands that people might be more familiar with. And it's still, I would say, somewhat of a bike geek niche, although that's a very large niche here. You could almost say that that's a mass market in Minnesota.
Yes, you could.
But they make such bike products or they have brands, including Surly, All City, Salsa bicycles. They have a range of different bikes that that they create. Although at this point, those bikes are not manufactured here. And Steve Flagg, who's the CEO of QBP, he told us that he wants to make a bike in Minnesota.
And surprisingly, that's not very common. It's not being done.
It isn't. Minnesota has boutique bike makers across the state that, you know, they've been doing this for years on a small scale where it's, you know, they're crafting the frame in their shop. But, you know, the capacity of a boutique bike maker, it doesn't match anything to what QBP could turn out. I think it'd be safe to say that an average boutique bike maker would make a dozen, maybe two dozen bikes in a year, and that would be a banner year. And because of the intense amount of labor that goes into each bike, they're pretty expensive most of the time. QBP is now operating in a space, and they haven't said what brand this would come under or what, you know, what would be slapped on the side of the frame once it's built. But they're looking, you know, at about 2 years out from having a bike that would be manufactured in Minnesota. So it's a pretty bold thing considering that right now roughly 95% of all bikes in the world are manufactured in Asia, primarily China, Taiwan.
They'd probably have a customer base right here as well.
Yeah, absolutely. When Molly and I went over to tour the facility, it's it has a very kind of progressive nonprofit ethos. These people are hardcore bikers. They don't need to go out and do market research. I'm sure they do market research, but they don't. It comes from the street.
Yeah.
These folks are riding bikes all day. They're, you know, commuting. They're figuring out, okay, one of the big things that Surly came out with a few years back were, you know, fat tire bikes. And so you can, it was initially something that you'd be able to ride on snow. It works in the desert well, so it's kind of in different surfaces. They also deal with a lot of bike commuters, people that are into the fixed gear bikes that you see a lot around town. So they are looking at this as a challenge, and they think that, you know, they could make money doing it.
Well, dovetailing quite nicely on this is the other part, another statewide blog on another local company, Park Tool.
Yeah, Park Tool is a very interesting company as well. They've been in business for 50 years, and they started at a bike shop in St. Paul. It was a Schwinn dealer, and ultimately there was, you know, much like you see with the types of models that QBP that they're rolling out, it's based on necessity or some perceived unmet demand. And the bike mechanic at Park Tool 50 years ago in St. Paul was tired of getting a sore back while working on bikes. And so he said, let's make something that can hold this bike up while I fix it. And so they made a bike stand, and it's something that you see in every bike shop now. And, the vast majority of those bike stands are from Park Tool. Basically, if you've taken your bike to a bike shop, your bike has been touched by Park Tools.
Park Tool.
There's a high likelihood of that.
And so where are they going in the future? We've heard QBP is hoping to make their own bicycle expand, I guess, in the Twin Cities. What about Park Tools?
They make 75% of their parts in St. Paul. They have 300 different tools that they make, and they make 75% of their parts here. The remaining 25% they make in China, are made in China, and they actually are bringing some of those parts back. They recently brought back some tools, some components, some smaller components of their bicycle stand, as a matter of fact, and they brought that back here.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Check it out at the statewide blog at nprnews.org.
Much of the clothing and other merchandise Americans buy is manufactured overseas in developing nations. But the workers making those products often work grueling hours in unsafe factories, risking their health and sometimes their lives for a few dollars a day. A sequence of tragedies in clothing factories has focused attention on the role Minneapolis-based Target and other major retailers play in these working conditions. Martin Moylan has a look.
Like any consumer here on Nicollet Mall in Minneapolis, Mary Owen enjoys a bargain. But when she gets a low price on some apparel that she knows could not have been made in the USA,
I feel a little guilty. It's actually something that I think about more often since the factory collapsed in Bangladesh.
Last April, more than 1,000 Bangladesh garment workers perished when the Rana Plaza collapsed. But just a few months before, fires in Bangladesh and Pakistan claimed hundreds more factory workers. And labor groups say those incidents are emblematic of unsafe and often fatal conditions in garment factories. If consumers are having second thoughts, retailers too have been thinking and talking more about the third world factories they rely on. In Cambodia, for example, there's been a surge in garment industry strikes over pay and working conditions. Target says it enforces hour, wage, safety, and other standards for the thousands of factories it deals with. Daniel Duty is vice president for global affairs.
We want to make sure we are doing the right thing in building safe, sustainable workplaces for people wherever we do business.
But Duty says that is a challenge in developing nations where workplace safety and other standards, if they exist, are often not enforced by factory owners or government authorities, especially in Bangladesh. Target, Walmart, and other major retailers have declared the safety record of factories in that country is flat out unacceptable. Still, Target does business with about 35 factories in Bangladesh, importing a relatively moderate $100 to $150 million worth of goods a year. Duty says Target, along with Walmart, is part of the Alliance for Bangladesh Worker Safety, an industry group that vows to improve working conditions.
We will all be on the same page. Retailers are free to develop standards that are higher, but at a minimum, there will be a common set of standards that meet the requirements of Bangladeshi law, as well as the requirements that have been put out by the International Labor Organization.
The ILO is an arm of the United Nations that works with governments, employers, and workers to set labor standards, including collective bargaining rights. Duty says Target did not do business with the Bangladesh factory that collapsed or the one that had a fire in which about 100 workers died. But a 2010 fire in a supplier's Bangladesh factory prompted the company to do longer inspections and focus on fire safety. Bangladesh is not the only country where Target finds factories need monitoring. Last year, for instance, Target reports it found problems with excessive work hours in a quarter of the Chinese factories that it audited and in a fifth of factories in South and Southeast Asia, Egypt, and Turkey. There were wage problems in two-thirds of Chinese factories, and in two dozen factories around the world, Target found evidence of child or forced labor or other transgressions that prompted it to stop doing business with the factories. But the advice from economists is don't flee.
Stay in there and work it through so that all the benefits of economic growth that come with sourcing from developing countries become available to these poor locations.
Tufts University economics professor Drusilla Brown is working with the UN's International Labor Organization. She says providing safe workplaces and paying workers the wages promised them pays off in the long run.
As attractive as low wages and long hours might seem to a firm trying to cut costs, we've actually found a lot of evidence better working conditions actually correlate with higher productivity and higher profits. It definitely doesn't have to be about exploitation.
Workers in factories in developing nations agree. Kalpona Akhtar is a former Bangladesh factory worker turned union organizer. She was interviewed recently on The Story.
In Bangladesh, we have 4 million workers and they are young. They really need this job. We need this job with dignity.
These days when companies cannot hide where things are made, they have to consider what it means to give or withhold that dignity.
That was Martin Moylan. One of the federal health care overhaul's main goals is to get patients more engaged in their own health care. The idea is that if patients better understand their health conditions, they can alert doctors to potential problems early and prevent complications. Closing out the podcast, Elizabeth Stawicki reports on one program that connects the traditional bathroom scale to the internet to keep heart failure patients out of the hospital.
Bill Hill says everyone should get 70 years on this earth. Any more is extra. So that's why he'll tell you this when you ask him how old he is.
Yeah, I'm 5 years past dead.
By Hill's math, that's 75 years old. Known to friends since he was a boy as Hill Billy, his name backwards. He believes he's been the beneficiary of extra time, particularly since he was diagnosed with heart failure more than 7 years ago. After working 39 years at Potlatch in Cloquet, he retired in 2000. Now, each day starts with a weigh-in that's become as routine as putting on his shoes.
Ready for health check? Do you want to check your weight? Please step on the scale.
The mechanical voice speaks out of a small box on his nightstand that's connected to a scale on the floor. When he gets on the so-called telescale, his weight shows up 24 miles away on nurse Denise Buxbaum's computer monitor at Essentia Health in Duluth.
So it's just a website that we go on to? Well, here's Bill.
Hill is one of about 300 heart failure patients in the Essentia program. If his weight goes up, a nurse or nurse practitioner will call him, because gaining even just an extra pound can signal a problem for heart failure patients. Something as simple as eating salt the day before can boost his weight. When you eat salt, you retain water, and a heart failure patient's heart is already weakened and can't handle the extra fluid, so it eventually can back up into the lungs. The nurse practitioner can prescribe a diuretic for 1 day, a medication that pulls water out of the body. Sometimes that's enough, other times it's not. But the scale provides a daily link to caregivers a half hour away.
These scales are a tool. They're not a treatment. They're a tool.
Linda Wick, nurse practitioner and manager of Essentia's heart failure program.
The bigger picture is that the nurses are talking to them. They're finding out what's going on. They're assessing, hey, maybe they ran out of their medications because they couldn't afford them. So the nurses can pull in resources to help them get their medications.
Essentia's heart failure program began in 1998 and has evolved over time. Wick says right now no more than 2% of the heart failure patients in the program need to be readmitted to the hospital within 30 days. That's a fraction of the national average of about 25%. Keeping heart failure patients out of the hospital is not only good for patients, it's also good for medical centers' bottom lines, particularly now. Last year, as part of the federal health care law, Medicare started penalizing hospitals that had too many heart failure readmissions. Susan Mendy, senior program officer of the nonprofit, nonpartisan Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, says such readmissions are expensive and put patients at risk.
Unnecessary readmissions really negatively affect people's health, and they put a huge burden on patients and their families, and they cost our country billions of unnecessary dollars. So I think we're seeing more and more strategies for better home management.
So Mendy says it's likely there will be more strategies to connect health providers with patients in their homes. And for Bill Hill, stepping on a scale once a day means that even at 5 years past dead, he and his wife can tend four horses on their hobby farm.
So I ride four-wheeler. I got a diesel tractor out there that I clean horse biscuits out of the pasture with and dump on a manure pile. And I don't work real hard, and I don't beat myself to death, but I stay active.
That activity not only keeps Hill healthy, but also keeps him out of the hospital and saves the healthcare system money.
Elizabeth Stawicki finishes off the Tuesday NPR News Update. Thanks for listening. The Hump Day podcast right back here tomorrow. I'm Phil Picardi. So long.